for anyone that needs reminding, to make a comment or to ask a question, go to the speaking queue, which is just above this list of people that are here. And then we put a queue and make sure that you enter it. And then I will come to you and invite you to speak or comment. Okay, thank you. Okay, floor's open. Paul.
Yeah, hello. Hi, Kevin. That was absolutely thoroughly interesting. I'm particularly keen to focus on living as I do in the west of Scotland and just about 10 or 15 minutes up the road from Rugby Park, home of Kilmarnock Football Club. You mentioned the whole Scottish links with Northern Ireland, and it's clear that there are many. You know, we're only about 40 minutes across the water from each other. But I know that in Scotland here, the whole kind of Protestant Catholic thing is still very much alive and kicking, not maybe as bad as it used to be during the peak and the height of the Troubles. But I'm just wondering to what extent or how prevalent it still is on the streets over there where you get, you know, where you reside. Certainly the Celtic and the Rangers support, there are very often dozens of coachloads of supporters arrive in Ayrshire every few weeks whenever we're playing against Glasgow Celtic or Glasgow Rangers. And, you know, it's not uncommon to see many of those supporters of trading past my house. You know, one week it'll be Celtic supporters with their tricolours chanting songs about fucking the Queen and the UDA and stuff like that. And then a few weeks later, you'll have equally obnoxious Rangers supporters with their Union Jacks singing songs about fucking the Pope and the IRA and things. So, you know, there's still a lot of that thing going on. I'm certainly witnessing, I don't even live in Northern Ireland. And when I say coach loads, I mean literally dozens of supporters turning up in bus loads, large and small. So, you know, and I mean, the back of that, I'm interested to know what have you experienced? What have you actually seen on the streets of Ireland when it comes to the whole religious kind of sectarian divide? It'd be good to hear a bit about that. Maybe not so much good, but certainly interesting. Cheers.
Thanks, Paul. Yeah, now I live in Cork, so it's not an issue down here, obviously, about that whole sectarian thing. I used to live in Belfast 25 years ago. For a number of years, and obviously it's present there. And I think it's still, as I understand it, I'm not living in Northern Ireland, and I'm wondering, is there someone here tonight who is in Northern Ireland? But I think it's certainly still there, that division. I think both governments in London and Dublin, they're probably a bit disappointed that in some ways the Good Friday Agreement, it's kind of kept the peace, but that's about all. I think it hasn't solved any fundamental issues between them. Just one other point in the discussion, it doesn't all have to go through me. I don't live in Northern Ireland, so I'm certainly no expert. So I'm happy to contribute to the discussion. But I'd say a lot of other members or people on the chat will know as much as I will about this, if that's okay.
Yeah, that's cool. Sorry, forgive me. I thought I wasn't sure exactly what part of that particular island you were on. I know that Nigel McCulloch, he's still in Northern Ireland. I'm not sure. I don't think Nigel's on tonight, but I'm sure he could have, if he was, had a lot to say about that. But anyway, no, thanks for that. And if anyone else is in that part of the world, it would be interesting to hear what their experience is. So thanks for that. Cheers.
Thanks, Paul. Mike?
Yeah, Kevin, you live in Cork. How long do you think before Sinn Féin become the government in the south? Because they look like they're becoming, a sort of a normal party rather than a nationalist party.
Well, I don't know myself, but certainly all the pundits seem to think it's at the next general election, unless something strange happens between now and then, they'll be the biggest party. Now, if they're the biggest, we have this obviously proportional representation, so it's still possible, which happened a bit in the last election, the other parties, like at the moment the government is Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael and the Greens, other smaller parties could come together just to exclude Sinn Féin. But I think going forward, that's will be less and less tenable. So at the moment, you'd have to say, I mean, none of us can predict the future. But, you know, certainly within 5 years, there'll be a Sinn Féin government. They're just an out-and-out capitalist party. I mean, for all their rhetoric, the only thing that probably marks them is their connection historically with whatever terrorism or guerrilla warfare, whatever you want to call it. But, I mean, there's no doubt. I mean, they've been in government in Northern Ireland for 20 years, and so they'll just be, you know, there's nothing particularly even generally left-wing about them. They'll just be a standard party. But they will, I think, in your question, I think they'll be in power soon enough down here in some form.
Thanks, Kevin.
Kevin, three little questions for you. I've just watched Ida Laws. It's about the Price Sisters and their involvement in the IRA. It's a documentary on Netflix. And the first question is, they spoke of socialism in their student days. They spoke of socialism. And I just wondered whether you could fill us in on what sort of socialism they were talking about. Were they Trotskyists, were they, whatever they were? The second question is, do you see a resurgence of the Troubles? And the third question is, do you ever see a united Ireland? Thank you.
Well, Carla, I'm aware of the Price Sisters, and I think they came from a privileged background. I have no really specific idea about their left wing ideology. Certainly, it's a long way from ours. But apart from that, I'm not sure. I think the resurgence of the Troubles is always a possibility. I'm sure it is, because fundamentally, you know, you've still two groups in Northern Ireland that live together but want different political outcomes. And, you know, if one of them gets... my understanding, when the IRA stopped the violence in the early 90s, it was because they reckoned they'd kind of run into a bit of a stalemate themselves. They were no longer really able to inflict any kind of heavy casualties on the British Army. So it was a tactical thing of, going on an armed strategy, you know, is more productive. But I mean, as to how long, you know, I mean, at some point, if in 100 years' time they're still talking about a united Ireland, is someone going to say, well, we're not really getting far down this political route? About the united Ireland, that's again is always possible. It's probably more possible or more likely now than it was before, but that still doesn't mean it's going to happen. The polling is out there. I think there's still a reasonable pro-union majority. But as I say, I think Scotland would be a game changer. I think if Scotland leaves the United Kingdom, it's kind of hard to see how Northern Ireland can remain in it long term after that. So, I mean, I'm assuming a Scottish referendum will come before a border poll, as they call it in Ireland. And in fact, I'd say Sinn Féin, they obviously want a united Ireland and they want a border poll, but they obviously want to win a border poll. And I'd say they themselves know, you know, they're hoping that Nicola Sturgeon, whatever, will get her referendum and obviously win it. And then I'd say there'll be a big push from Sinn Féin and Republicans in Ireland to have a referendum in Ireland.
Thank you, Kevin. Steve.
Thanks, Kevin. Really enjoyed your talk. I don't know whether you'd be able to answer this or not. I come to understand recently, you know, like in the past three or four months, they've been talking about this, the agreement not to kill each other. Sorry, it's just completely lost. The
Good Friday, Belfast Agreement.
Thank you. The Good Friday Agreement. Why was it such a threat, supposedly, that if there was a decision to introduce border controls, why would that be a threat? Why are working class Catholics or working class Protestants going to get involved in some sort of shooting match with each other just because you've got border controls? Any clarifications on that?
Well, it is true. A party is symbolic. like any border is. I think one thing that's not fully understood about the border between the north and the south, it's, you know, formally it's a border between the UK and the Republic of Ireland, but, and it's not even a border between a sort of Protestant part of Ireland and a Catholic part of Ireland. The way that Protestants are unionists, they're not uniformly spread out throughout Northern Ireland. They tend, even within Northern Ireland, to be very much concentrated over in the north or the east. So what you find is, apart from some parts, on either side of the border, it's all Irish nationalists, north and south, because the nationalists in Northern Ireland tend to be in the west and south. So for them, a border is of any type, of any sort of whatever people are on it, in terms of manning it or womaning it or whatever, it tends to be an affront. And I think a border would kill Sinn Féin, because they couldn't possibly claim that, you know, this Good Friday Agreement was delivering their agenda of United Ireland. If people then say, well, sure, you know, we're showing our passports or we're being stopped. I mean, obviously, throughout the history of Northern Ireland, there was customs at one stage, and that went away when both countries, Ireland and Britain, joined the European Union. And during the Troubles, there wasn't customs, but there were obviously checkpoints, military and police checkpoints. Of course, it's a social point of view. Why does that really matter to Catholic or Protestant workers? Obviously, it shouldn't. They're just been, you know, they've been entangled in a struggle of nationalism that, you know, I'm just giving the standard socialist case here, that obviously has no real future for them and won't solve their problems. But it just, why it is an issue is just because people, nationalists in Northern Ireland, believe, at least a good few of them, they want to be Irish, they don't want to be British, and, you know, they want that to be manifested in their lives. They want to see basically tricolours flying from public buildings. They don't want to see the Union flag. And the opposite, obviously, applies to Protestants or Unionists.
Thank you. John, you're up next.
I find it ironic that the so-called Democratic Unionist Party has got its wish on Brexit, but by achieving that in the face of, I think, the majority of people in Northern Ireland, the majority of the electorate there voted stay in Europe. But notwithstanding that, the so-called DUP has supported Brexit, but now, ironically, this has brought forward the thing that it seems to dread the most, which is a united Ireland. It's just one of those strange things where a capitalist supporting party can quite often shoot itself in the foot. As for British capitalist class, I think the majority of them, certainly the big capitalists, didn't want Brexit, but it was only a section of the capitalist class who would see Brexit as being in their interest. And, you know, these things are, although the capitalist class sort of dominates society and things work in the interest of the capitalist class, it doesn't mean that they always get exactly their own way. And it was interesting that the British government, notwithstanding the fact that, you know, when the results were first announced, the people in office clearly didn't want that to be the result. Nevertheless, they knew that, or they felt scared not to implement the wishes, or seem to implement the wishes of the majority. And that's just an interesting thing, by the way, which probably augurs well for the future, that having consulted their human livestock, i.e. the working class, as to how things are run, they feel as though they have to at least have the appearance of implementing the decision.
Yeah, I think you're spot on there, John. Yeah, I agree on both counts. The DUP doesn't seem to make much sense the way it's worked out. And probably, yeah, for the British government, obviously, yeah, they were, capitalists don't always, obviously, you know, they don't control every aspect of society. But I still find it slightly strange that they didn't put more effort, I mean, the British capitalist class, to stay within Europe. I mean, they certainly could have made more, I'm sure, effort on promoting, you know, the so-called benefits of being in the EU. I mean, fundamentally, they're benefits for them. I'm not sure if other people have ideas or suggestions on this.
Hi, Darren.
Hi. Really, question for Kevin. Interesting talk, Kevin. I'm really intrigued by this idea of, you know, Sinn Féin in the South potentially being the largest, you know, party in the, is it the Doyle, come the next election, and the implications that means for this whole, like, age-old question of the possible reunification of, you know, the North and the South. I mean, I don't really follow Irish politics that much, so I apologise. So I'm curious. I mean, one is, if they were to be the largest party, who would they possibly go in coalition with of those parties? You know, how strong is the political will to push from the South for a referendum? Because I presume there'd have to be a referendum both North and South. And secondly, following on from that, the implications for the North, because, you know, from the outside looking in, you know, everybody talks about, you know, everybody sort of wonders about the potential for the resumption of sectarian violence, you know, and I get the impression they're always talking about, like, from the Republican side, you know, so you had the groups like the Continuity IRA, you know, Real IRA, etc. But the implications this would mean from the loyalist side, because I'm guessing that if you have, you know, a political will in the South to try and push for a referendum, surely that means that rather than it being the Irish Republicans in the North, like, digging up their guns that they never gave up, it will be the loyalists, you know. And I'm just intrigued, you know, if you could, you know, if you've wondered what could be the sort of how it could play out, you know, if and when Sinn Féin become the largest, because they have to, yeah, I presume, you know, like, sorry, talking too much here, but I'm also curious about Sinn Féin in office. You know, they get away with in the North with power sharing. It's the system set up in such a way that they power shared. We had the images of the late McGuinness, Martin McGuinness, and the late Ian Paisley, etc., like sharing platforms, sharing government. But I'm wondering how it plays out in the South for Sinn Féin, because they have to run capitalism. But at the same time, like the SNP in Scotland, they have this ultimate goal of, you know, independence, etc. So they have to be seen to be trying to deliver on this question, even if they ultimately cannot, you know, if they don't have the political will to pull it in that direction. I'm just curious how things could play out and the implications that has for, like, Irish politics in the South, you know, like, for the next 4 or 5 years, you know. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Darren. Well, as I say, Sinn Féin, it's are likely to be the biggest party. As to who they'll go to coalition with, it actually could be any party. We have a system down here for the last, it's 30 or more years, is it 40 years, since any party has won an overall majority. So it's always coalition government. So, and it's a bit like the sham of a lot of capitalist politics. The parties, they'll tear strips of each other during the election. But then when the numbers come in and they know how many seats they have, then they're looking around as to who they go into coalition with. And it's surprising how little ideology matters. So parties on the right can actually end up having coalitions with parties on the left. I mean, as for Sinn Féin, the obvious party is Fianna Fáil, who are the traditional kind of nationalist party. There's quite a few small left-wing parties in the Dáil as well at the moment. I'm not sure how keen they'd be going to with Sinn Féin. I mean, Sinn Féin are a bit like Fianna Fáil used to be 70, 80 years ago. They are a bit of a catch-all party. They can push this kind of left-wing image, but at the same time, they can be quite right-wing too. And so it's a lot of it is smoke and mirrors, I think. It's a good point about, does the South want unification? I mean, formally, it used to be in the Irish Constitution that we were all in the South, gung-ho. That's the big thing we wanted more than anything, is to see a united Ireland. And I mean, that's probably still true at an emotional level. The question has always been raised, though, as you exactly point out, you know, if there was unity, well, what would happen with at least the determined unionists who didn't want to be united with the South? Would they think, well, if the IRA can use violence against the British state, we're entitled then to use violence against the Irish state to get our way? And that's obviously one issue. And the other thing, of course, is the money. I mean, you know, when Northern Ireland was set up, the intention from the Treasury in London was that it would be self-supporting. In fact, that was never the case, even well before the Troubles. Northern Ireland, you know, basically, without getting too mean about it, the English taxpayer basically always had to fork in or kick in money to Northern Ireland to keep it going. Now, the British economy is probably still 10 times larger than the Irish economy. So there's no way the Republic of Ireland, you know, would have the resources to give the kind of money, the billions that Northern Ireland gets from the GB, what they term the GB taxpayer. So, you know, it's a point, you know, if there were, and there would have to be a referendum on both sides of the border, you know, it's still probably pass in the south, I think. But I mean, there's no doubt the issues of loyalist violence and the money would be raised. So probably still would win, but who knows? I mean, I don't get all this is so it's interesting for a political thing, but of course, you know, whatever which way Northern Ireland goes, it doesn't advance socialism one little bit. So that's obviously our main interest in all this.
Okay, thanks. There's no one in the speaking queue at the moment. I'm just wondering whether perhaps we could kind of explore this whole nationalism idea thing and who we think, you know, is perpetrating these divisive idea. Okay, we have some people now. Freddie.
Yes, thank you, Carla, and thank you, Kevin, for your address this evening. There's been some considerable comment about the respective religions or the primary religions in Northern Ireland and Erin. And I'm just interested to sort of know in that you know, where do you believe the business class or the sort of the capitalists within Ireland lie in that sort of area? Is there any inference from what you say that the respective owning classes are divided along those lines also? I mean, I fully recognise some of the comments that have been made about, you know, supporters coming over from Ireland. And let me say now, I mean, I've been a lifelong Celtic supporter for 60 years now and still go and see them play. So I'm well aware of the religious divides, etc., that exist. And there's not only boatloads of Celtic supporters and Rangers supporters coming over from Ireland during the football seasons. When I'm coming up from England, there's busloads of supporters coming up from England as well, from those respective clubs. But the question is really, you know, is there a suggestion that the owning class in Ireland fester this sort of divide? I mean, where do they stand? Or is it just convenient for them to have workers at each other's throats in those ways?
It's a very good question, Freddie. I'm not sure what the answer is. 100 years ago, I think one of the claims by the capitalists in Dublin were disappointed with the border was because they could see, you know, Northern Ireland was kind of industrial and Southern Ireland was agricultural. So, you know, there might have been a good linkage. There might have been benefits for the owning, the business class, the people who own capital. I mean, right now, myself, I don't really, I mean, there's going to be small-scale capitalists and there's some businesses along the border, you know, in border counties in Ireland, they might see advantages to having, you know, having a single country. But, you know, clearly for the big US multinationals, it's irrelevant to them whether, you know, they couldn't care less about unity, whether it happens or not. Apart from the fact, I know those, you know, what's important for multinationals locating down south, and there is some multinationals in the north too, they want a stable, they don't want terrorism, they don't want violence. So I'd say for the capitalist interest is they don't really care if the workers want to get worked up about being Protestant or Catholic or being unionist or nationalist, they're not fussed either way. Once there isn't the costs that come with violence and you know, the friction that violence tends to put on business. That'd be my opinion anyway. Maybe other people, though, might have other views.
Sorry, Adam, I think you're next. I've just deleted you. Adam?
Yeah. I may be the only person here with some direct connection with Northern Ireland. My father was born in Northern Ireland, in Ballymena, in County Antrim. And you can tell his name was the same as mine. Anybody called Adam in Northern Ireland is bound to be a Protestant, because Catholics have to be named after a saint, and Adam isn't a saint. And the name Buick is a Scottish name. And in fact, we used to go there for holidays in the 1950s and 60s. And my uncle said, "We're not Irish, we're Scottish." And until the Troubles, I had difficulty telling the difference between a Scottish accent and a Northern Ireland accent, especially a west of Scottish accent. But having said that, my aunt's name was Adam, so you can't tell from the person's surname which foot they dig with. But my father, he wanted to smoke and drink, and he couldn't do that in the Northern Ireland, so he left. It's some of my cousins still live there, and in the I think it was the 1950s, one election in 1950, one of these cousins, he supported there was a Liberal Party candidate that stood against the Unionists, and of course he was denounced as a nationalist. I mean, this was just for opposing the Unionist candidate. Incidentally, he moved down to live in the south of Ireland. But he then came across another problem. He met a woman, and he's living with her. But she, of course, was already married. Well, of course, but she was already married, and they couldn't get married because she couldn't get divorced. I'm going back now to the 60s and no, the 70s and 80s maybe. But to come back to the other thing I was going to say is the connection between the North of Ireland and Scotland. One of the consequences of the Good Friday Agreement is that, that there's some sort of recognition for the Irish language, which I don't think many people in Northern Ireland speak. I think some people in the island of Rathlin Island actually speak Scottish Scottish Gaelic. But anyway, the counterpart for that was that it's now an official language in Northern Ireland is Ulster Scots. But I think there is a political advance with the Good Friday Agreement. What it has done is taken the border out of Northern Irish politics, because every election up until then, you know, was the issue was the border. It was partition. There were anti-partitions. There were unionists. That was the only issue. As I say, the consequence of one of my cousins standing or supporting the Liberal Party, you didn't get a word in edgeways. And I don't think I'll be betraying any secret. I mean, Nigel is not here, but he told me that in fact in that referendum he voted for the Good Friday Agreement. So I would say that has been an advance, because it's allowed politics in. I was going to say that. Well, I do say actually in the North of Ireland to be. To become less sectarian, and I think now they've got cross-sectional parties there. The Alliance Party, which is I think affiliated to the Liberal Party here, and the Green Party, and these parties do have some influence. In fact, they hold the balance of power. I it's a pity Nigel isn't here, because I think in fact if you're elected to Northern Ireland, you have to declare whether you're a unionist or a nationalist, because there are some special majorities to pass certain types of legislation. So, I mean, as I say, I come back to it again. I think that the disappearance of partition as an issue has been an advance, even as far as we're concerned as socialists. Okay, thanks.
Yeah, great to hear you there, Adam. I agree with all that. It's all true. I mean, so the advantage of the Good Friday Agreement was it stopped the killing. It didn't stop the conflict, which is just basically it's like on these conversations, it's muted a bit, but it's still there. I mean, I think a socialist we would, you know, support the Good Friday Agreement as a reform. It's, you know, it's really a matter of, you know, how different parts of the world are separated into countries. It's nothing to do with socialism, but obviously if it stops people killing each other, and if in some small way it allows other political ideas rather than are you for the border, are you against the border, to be out there, that's a good thing. And, you know, whether sectarianism is there or not doesn't obviously make our case easier or less easy. I mean, you know, sectarianism doesn't really exist in England or in the Republic of Ireland, at least not most of it. And it doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to make hay. But it's of course we all welcome not having violence.
Okay, Mark, you're up next.
Yeah, thanks, Kevin. That was very informative. You brought a lot of threads together. I appreciated that. And my question actually was kind of touched on by Adam, and it was generally in the direction. My question was in the direction of the sort of the specific cultural historical identity of the Ulster people, which seems to be potentially going to become an issue if there is a move to a United Ireland. And I watched today on YouTube a sort of some BBC documentary, I think probably from the 60s, perhaps, maybe around the time of 1971, where they were interviewing, you know, some Catholics in Northern Ireland and some street interviews and some Ulster people. And there was one interview with one Ulsterman where he said that he'd been to England and he'd found, although he was, you know, part of the Union, he'd found that he wasn't really English and, you know, didn't really belong. He'd been down to Ireland and he found that he didn't really belong there. He obviously at that point pointed to the very pervasive influence of the Catholic Church, which I presume has changed radically. But, you know, he made the point that everything revolves around the church down in the south. And he said, you know, so I actually discovered through this process of me trying to find out which, you know, where I fit in, that actually I belong to a very distinct group of people, you know, the Ulster people. And, you know, we're never going to sort of just go away, as it were. And I'm just wondering if you've got any, I mean, Adam kind of talked about that as well. Have you got any thoughts on the, you know, that they, the particular, I mean, I presume that they may well have very particular concerns. And I think this is one of the things about nationalism. It's not just top down. I mean, very often it's based upon genuine, legitimate concerns of various ethnic groups and language groups and historical groups, that their interests, for example, linguistic interests and cultural interests, will not be swamped or in some way run over by an undemocratic majority. Have you any thoughts about this? And that, of course, leads to the potential of defensive, you know, so-called defensive violence. You know, in other words, the digging up of the guns exactly by the Ulster Defence people who find their country being, as it were, stolen from them. I wonder if you have any comments on that, Kevin.
You're correct there, Mark. The people, the Ulster people, and Ulster, when people say Ulster people, they're usually about the Unionists or the Protestant people. There's about a million of them, I think, who live up in Northern Ireland. They certainly don't at all regard themselves as Irish, at least as Irish in the sense that it's meant now. I think, again, 100 years ago, Irish, you could be, well, the cliche was you could be Irish and British. Now it's much more binary. But, I mean, obviously, I'm not supporting or promulgating a United Ireland. It's for the people who want a United Ireland to explain, well, what exactly are they going to do with these people? I mean, they don't want to be in a United Ireland. I mean, some, you know, to different views, sometimes you have very, what I call, hardline Unionists. I think the leader of the DUP, Arlene Foster, has said that if a United Ireland ever came about, she would, even though she's from Northern Ireland, or her parents and grandparents, they probably go back centuries, she would leave Northern Ireland if a United Ireland happened. Other sort of Unionists or part of the Ulster people, or they could probably tolerate a United Ireland, especially now, as you say. It's not like when I was growing up, and even before that, when every, you know, the Catholic Church pretty well, all social matters were in fact just were it wasn't the Dáil, the nominal democratic system that organized healthcare education. It was the Catholic Church that basically ran the show. That's not the case now. I mean, the Catholic Church, of course, is still present, and you know, whereas religious observance is far, far lower than before, but it's still there. But yeah, I mean, and I agree. I mean, obviously, we don't support, obviously, I certainly don't support ethnic or identity politics, but I do agree every group is entitled to have their voice held, even if we feel they're mistaken. So the Ulster people, yeah, that's obviously going to be the big issue. That I mean, they've got to vote for a United Ireland, and even if the vote even in Northern Ireland is for United Ireland, you're still going to have these people who have lived in Northern Ireland for hundreds of years, and what's to be done with them? And that you don't end up with the reverse of what happened before. But again, as I said, it's up for, I think it's national, people who believe in nationalism have to solve those problems. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, the socialist view is that while you have countries, you're always going to have minorities in countries who are not happy because they're artificial countries. They're just lines on the map. And sometimes you might get lucky and everyone in a country is from one ethnic group and they're all completely happy. But most times you don't, and you've got these different groups. And that's why I think borders, all the strife and violence, borders are changing. People move with the migrations and countries that were homogenous are no longer homogenous, and that leads to issues. So, I mean, I think we're all agreement that the only solution is obviously socialism to the problem of nationalism and, of course, all the other problems of capitalism.
Okay, John?
I think the sorry situation in Northern Ireland doesn't really suit any particular section of the capitalist class. This is just a consequence of their ancestors having played the orange card, etc. And in order to get working class support. And now over a century later, all these prejudices that have been dinned into the heads of the workers are still there, long past the time when any material interest was served. I mean, even the British government in recent times has said, not quite correctly, or certainly not telling quite the truth, but they claim to have no selfish or strategic interest in Northern Ireland. That was when they were trying to get confidence amongst people generally for the Good Friday Agreement. It's just a pity that workers have fallen for all of this stuff, and over the years of the Troubles, as they called them in Northern Ireland, the end effect of it all was to push out some of the people who were sort of more standard supporters of capitalism and more in tune with, you know, peaceful kind of politics. These people were pushed out by the two extreme sides. And the result of all these people being murdered and murdering each other in Northern Ireland was to let people like Dr. Paisley and the wee butcher boy into office. And to see those two smiling and laughing and joking together, it was just vomit-making when both of them were heavily involved in the deaths of all these people. And it just shows you just how hypocritical these people are just to get political power for themselves. As I say, it doesn't serve the interest of any section of the capitalist class to have this whole sorry thing going on. And Brexit has just made the whole thing much worse for all concerned. And it's just a shame that members of the working class are going to fight, perhaps kill each other over what silly flag, whether it be red, white and blue, green, white and gold, or green, white and orange, whatever you want to call it. It just seems quite senseless to us as socialists.
Paddy?
Yeah, I just... it's been an interesting discussion, this. I just want to kind of interject a sort of, I don't know, a materialist perspective, I suppose, you know, where the... where the sort of material interests are. I mean, it occurred to me that, for example, it's well known that the UK is one of the biggest global arms dealers, and one of its big companies, Shorts, is based in Belfast. So, I mean, that's just a thing to throw in there. There's been a lot of talk about, you know, Scottish independence as like a kind of parallel to the Irish thing, but I'm not sure it's the best analogy. I was thinking during the discussion that maybe a better analogy might be Catalonia, in fact, because in both situations you've got what was a fairly rich industrial northern region, so Northern Ireland was, or Ulster was, the kind of northern powerhouse, and so was Catalonia. Both of them wanted to be separate from the south, except with the Catalonia's case, it was a matter of separatism. With Northern Ireland, it was unionism. But, it's the same sort of process. But what I'm really interested in asking Kevin is something that, if you could sort of elaborate a bit on something, an interesting point he made, which was that the south is actually now better off than the north. Now, this seems to me that this would tip the scales the other way. It might actually suggest that the south would be less in favour of uniting than it used to be. Even in spite of the popularity of Sinn Féin, and maybe Kevin can correct me if I'm wrong, but I seem to remember reading that opinion polls in the south have actually been against a united Ireland in recent years. I don't know if Kevin can confirm or deny that. That's it.
Hi, Paddy. Yeah, I think shorts there. I think they were owned by Bombardier, the Canadian aerospace company. But they've struggled too. I can't even remember as a result of Brexit. They're not doing so well now. They might even be reliant on British government defence contracts for their operation. I say it's a real pity we don't have someone from Northern Ireland or living in Belfast or wherever. They know much more about this. But from the southern point of view, the Catalonia thing is actually very interesting. Yeah. I didn't think of that, but that is a very good analogy. Yeah, and a similar rationale. I mean, somebody, they just feel, we're a wealthy, progressive region, and we're kind of being lumped in with the far poorer region, and the flows of wealth are going to be one way from us to them, and we're better off on our own. The South is richer now. Now, the thing about the South as well, we have always had a much more volatile economy. The South basically, Southern Ireland went bust basically 11 years ago, and the Troika, I can't remember, was it the ECB and the monetary international monetary fund had to come in and rescue it. So, Southern Ireland is wealthier now than the North. But who's to say how long that'll last for two? I mean, to an extent, our economic wealth is precarious because it does depend on these multinationals, and they're out and out capitalists. They're here because they can make money here. But the day they stop making money in Ireland is the day they move on to Hungary or Taiwan or wherever other part of the world there's more money to be made. I think the polling thing is interesting. Officially, it's almost, you wouldn't question, of course, 100% of the Irish people would vote for unity. But you're quite right. The polling is much more nuanced because people are worried about, the costs involved. It's been such an abstract thing that people really haven't thought about it. So I don't think the polls are very useful. I think if someone said there's going to be a border poll in 3 years' time, then people would start thinking about it, and then you might hear the arguments for and against it, and then the polls would be probably a more indicative guide. It's just that my impression, when you poll anybody about something that's a long way off, people, they don't think about it much because they think, well, it's never going to happen anyway, so it doesn't matter what I say. Sorry, I'm not sure if any of that was added much to the discussion, but there. So I'm finished there. Sorry, is that?
Yeah, Kevin. I'm just looking. Darren said he didn't want to speak. So, Mike Brown.
Thanks. Quite interesting, Kevin. This stuff. I believe that the when I left Ireland in '68, I couldn't wait to get out of it because of the among other things, the domination of the Catholic religion. But that's retreated quite a lot with all the scandals that came to light about the Catholic religion and their behavior. So I don't think there's too much difference between, it's not a worry anymore. I can go back and live there if I could get my pensions coming over from here to there, because it's a better climate. But I don't think there's too much to do about the you know, those football teams and stuff like that. I mean, if I was living in Ireland, in South, in the Republic, I wouldn't like to have the Ulster Protestants in that country, because they're equivalent to the fascists or the white supremacists in the US. They used to dominate all the other people. They used to have privilege jobs. They were the one, they got the key jobs, the working class. So they lorded over the Catholics. They're quite likely to go violent because they were the ones that brought the violence in and kept it. So, I think joining the common market, as it was then, for the two places, England and Ireland, was quite good because it took out most of the difference in economics between them. But is it true that most people don't go to mass anymore, or, you know, all that sort of rubbish?
Broadly speaking, that's true. Yeah, I don't know the exact figures, but I obviously, it's funny, what killed off the Catholic Church, but what really damaged it wasn't a load of socialist or atheist propaganda. It was particularly, I think, those child sex abuse scandals that came to light, and the fairly disgusting and grisly record of the Catholic Church in dealing with them, or and of course not dealing with them even when they knew what was going on. I'm assuming religious observance in Ireland, it's probably a bit more than the European norm, but obviously it's nothing like it was, I guess, when you were growing up, Mike. But you know, that's a long-term trend. But I mean, as I say, there's nothing particularly socialist to be gained from that. You know, I mean, England is a fairly obviously atheistic country, and it's not like just because people obviously don't believe in religion, they'll be socialists. But, you know, of course, we'd like to see the end of religion, like we'd like to see the end of countries.
Okay, Darren?
Yeah, I mean, I guess that kind of reminded me of what I was going to say previously. It's basically what Mike said about, you know, the extreme Ulster unionism. And, well, first of all, I'm still trying to get my head around this idea of there being like a referendum both north and south on this question. I just can't see it. You know, I can't see it, especially in the north. But if you were going to indulge in futurology, you know, which I think the party does too much at times, but and there was to be this vote for unification north and south, you know, you could actually envisage a scenario of was like part of the deal being like the British offering passports, British passports to Ulster unionists if in the event of losing the referendum and Ireland becoming united again. And I'm just kind of laughing at the idea of like 30 to 40,000 like Ulster unionists turning up in the west of Scotland. What that would actually result in Scottish politics, because like as somebody touched upon, I think it was Paul, it's daft to talk about this in 2021, but you know the obviously these numbers or these sort of people don't exist in the same numbers as they did like even 30, 40 years ago, but they're all the noisier for it, and they do exist, and the impact that they would have on British politics, if suddenly all these Ulster unionists turned up in the British mainland, it's kind of funny. And I'm sure that's one of the reasons why, another reason rather, why I think all sides probably would just prefer a stalemate to continue, to pretend that they want reunification, to pretend they want Ulster to remain part of Britain, but just to continue business as usual. I mean, if you talk like what the British capitalist class want or the Irish capitalist class want, that's probably the ideal scenario, but they just obviously wouldn't say that out loud because there is obviously constituencies on each side who don't want to hear that. You know, they don't want business as usual. You know, that's just, as I say, that just struck me when somebody mentioned about Arlene Foster leaving Ulster and et cetera, et cetera. You know, that's me finished.
Yeah, I think you're right there, John. But obviously, even if 100,000 or a quarter of a million Ulster Unionists left to Britain, the population of Britain, I think now is it over 65 million, they'd easily it could easily accommodate them. Somebody's pointed out it's a funny thing about the border poll. In some ways, the Unionists have played their hand very badly because the current official constitutional position is that Northern Ireland remains, part of the UK as long as the majority there want it. But if they vote to go into the Republic, then that's the end of the Union. They become united with the South. But that's not reciprocated. Once they go into the South, that's it. They're in. There's no sort of, we've changed our mind now. We want to go back. So the situation, in some ways, it benefits the South. It's like all the South has to do, or at least all the people in the South or the North who want Ireland to be united again. They just have to have, once they get their one chance, that's it. So I'm sure you're right. Probably a lot of Ulster, well, we talked about the Ulster people before, some probably would find it, even though the religion probably won't be a big issue formally, but they probably just, they prefer to be in Britain. It's a pity, all right, that it's now 2021 and yet nationalism is still has such a grip on it. I think that's terrible. Like, it's, we've definitely seen a decline in religion, but it's a pity we're not seeing a similar decline in nationalism, because it certainly, I think, hinders our case.
Okay, John?
Yes, I saw a documentary recently, and something someone said earlier that reminded me of this. It was a documentary, I think it must have been about the rise of Sinn Féin on both sides of the border in the Irish Republic and in the six counties. And what it brought out there was the usual sort of hypocrisy of capitalist supporting parties, because in the north they had to appeal to a certain constituency, generally speaking, supported the idea of a united Ireland, which incidentally had never existed until the British actually united it. So that's an interesting little feature from history. But apart from that, when they interviewed people in the Irish Republic, most of them weren't interested in Sinn Féin's agenda to take back, as they would see it, Northern Ireland. What they were interested in were questions to do with housing and education and the standard sort of things that you would expect in a normal capitalist bourgeois so-called democracy. So Sinn Féin had to tailor its case to those particular electorates and not emphasise too much in the South all this stuff about Northern Ireland, because it really seems to, so far as I can tell, put off a lot of people, perhaps the majority, in the Irish Republic. So that was quite an interesting thing to see. Nothing new for us to find hypocrisy amongst capitalist supporting parties, but it certainly confirmed what we already knew.
Yeah, I've been to Belfast a couple of times. I've got a friend that lives in Bangor, which is just down the road. And when she was showing me around Belfast, it actually felt, this was about 4 years ago, the last time I was there, and it felt very divided to me. You've got that great big huge wall that I think runs down the Falls Road. My friend was saying to me that just be careful what you say and how loud you say it, because, it can cause a problem. So it actually felt quite intimidating and quite still very divided to me. Adam?
to go back to something that Darren said, I think a stalemate is the best situation for us as well. Because I mean, obviously we don't get involved in the nitty-gritty of capitalist politics, but if we had a choice, we should oppose any border poll or any referendum. Because as was demonstrated by the one in Britain, Brexit, it just unleashes nationalist feelings. And I would hope that there's never going to be a border poll and there won't be a referendum in Scotland either. I mean, which might not happen now. I see they're really stirring it up to defeat the SNP and undiscredit it. And I think that's a good thing. If we can avoid having these borders, inevitably the capitalist politicians are going to appeal to the worst side of people. But I would like to make one point though, that not all the people in, not all the Protestants in the north of Ireland are bigoted orange men. I mean, my father's family wasn't, and in fact my aunt said, we don't have any trouble with the Catholics here in Ballymena because they're all rich. They were pub owners and cattle dealers. The places that you were shown, Carla, in Belfast are the slum areas. In other parts, it isn't like that. And in fact, the people, I don't think if there was unity with North and South, that many people would, in fact, leave Northern Ireland, because, I mean, you know, Mark mentioned an interview with somebody in 1970, so they didn't feel at home either in the south of Ireland or in England. But in fact, I think people from the north of Ireland do find they've got more in common with Dublin than they do with London. Lots of them have moved down there to work. And on the question of sport, okay, I realize that when it comes to soccer, you've got Rangers and Celtic, but in rugby, Ireland has a single team of players from the north and the south. Now, I realized at one point, the Republicans wouldn't let people play rugby or soccer for that matter. But I mean, Ireland is still one. As far as rugby is concerned, and as I said, my father was a supporter of Ireland whenever Ireland played against England. So the people in the north of Ireland, even people of Protestant background, do to a certain extent regard themselves as Irish, and they are.
Yeah, just if I could respond to that, I think Adam is correct, of course. I mean, I think nowadays Catholics in Northern Ireland are probably as rich as Protestant, and I don't think Catholics are any more left-wing than Protestant or right-wing. I think you'll find, obviously, a mix of opinions on all sides. I mean, going back maybe 50, 60 years ago, there was definite there was a marked difference in incomes between Catholics and Protestants, but that's not the case now. They're all as rich or as poor, and most of them are poor, of course, as each other. One thing where I would take issue with what I'm suggesting about our attitude to a poll, whether it's Scottish independence or a poll for United Ireland, I don't think we'd be, well, I think we're just neutral. I think we're saying, you know, the UK or Republic of Ireland could divvy up the British Isles in any which way they want, but it's not going to resolve any issue. I mean, of course, this kind of nationalist polling does inflame tensions, and it certainly can lead to violence. But that's not our fault. I mean, you know, unfortunately, as I think John was saying, workers do have imbibed a lot of this kind of nationalist nonsense, and that can be taken too far. But I mean, I blame the people who promulgate nationalist ideologies wherever they come from. They're the ones who've got blood in their hands. I mean, we were talking about, somebody was mentioned about Martin McGuinness and Ian Paisley. And obviously, Martin Guinness was openly involved in violence. And there's even videos of him taking guns out of boots of cars to use against people. I mean, Paisley, of course, was Paisley reminded me a bit like Donald Trump and that assault on the Capitol, that he was great at inciting it, violence. And then when it actually happened, he was, oh, nothing to do with me at all. You know what I mean? The crowd were worked up anyway. They would have done this. So, as I say, let's hope there's a day soon enough when there isn't any countries. That's me finished. Sorry for this bit.
Darren?
Just a wee quick reply to Adam, because he's mentioned Ballymena a couple of times, obviously because of his family connections. I mean, arguably the most famous person that I know of from in recent years from Ballymena is Liam Neeson, the actor Liam Neeson. And it was only like 15, 20 years ago that Ballymena Town Council, I believe, like offered him like the freedom of the town because of, you know, famous son and everything. And he knocked it back. And the reason he knocked it back is because he was a Catholic growing up in Ballymena. And he basically, he turned around and said, he says, you know, I'm sorry, but, you know, Ballymena made me. But at the same time, as a Catholic, I was considered a second-class citizen my whole life growing up here, you know. And like, so I don't think these sort of sectarian peculiar, you know, this sort of sectarianism is peculiar to like just parts of Belfast or Derry or like Armagh. are, pour it down or whatever. This was very real and very ingrained, going back many, many years. And also, just to clarify, it's not soccer, Adam, it's football, just to, very important. That's corrected. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Darren. John? It's John now?
Yes, Kevin's remarks about the similarity between Dr. Paisley and Donald Trump were very apt, I thought. And it just reminded me of something concerning the history of Northern Ireland. I think the early history of Northern Ireland was partly a result of insurrection on the part of the Protestant side in Northern Ireland. And that was the result of a certain section of the capitalist class wishing to remain within the British Empire, as it was at that time. So that's just an interesting facet of this whole sorry business.
Yeah, funny, we've been talking about Ballymena, and I passed through it. I don't live in Northern Ireland, but I was up there last summer just for a week's holidays. But we went through Ballymena, and what I was kind of thought still a bit sad to see was, I think it's broadly speaking, it's regarded as a unionist town, and but there was one pretty miserable looking estate that had all these pictures of the hunger strikers outside and tricolours flying everywhere. And I thought, even 25 years after the Good Friday Agreement, as somebody else mentioned, I think it was Carla, I presume that's a kind of a Catholic ghetto, basically, and I'm sure there's lots of other Catholics living in around Ballymena, but it's sad to see, all right, that the two communities, at least I think at the maybe at the poor end of the spectrum, they're still very divided in terms of, and they still feel the need to put up tricolours or union flags to say this is us, this is our area, whatever. But I think, it was John's comment is spot on. Actually, it was actually a section of the capitalist class. I forgot that who started in Northern Ireland, because obviously for capitalist reasons they felt their whole livelihoods, the big industries of Belfast, they needed to be part of the British Empire. They needed to be connected to Britain. That there was no future for Harland and Wolff being part of a fairly small country like Ireland. So it's true. I think the needs of capitalism were central, maybe not central, but they were certainly important in setting up Northern Ireland. I mean, as I say, I think it's come from tonight's discussion. It is hard to see why capitalism would have any, apart from the point, maybe the current situation from a capitalist point of view might be the best. I can't see capitalists on either side getting too worked up about the business opportunities of either Northern Ireland remaining in the UK or Northern Ireland becoming a part of the Republic.
Yeah, the thing that I kind of understand, those families that are still basically holding on to their enmities and stuff like this. I mean, the thing is, if you've had a child, if you've had a son or a father that was killed or murdered, you're not going to forgive that easily just because the top boys have made up and the politicians are all friends again, and the opportunists. These families are still suffering. They lost people. So I can understand why they are not suddenly saying, oh yeah, okay, let's all forgive and make up. So I guess that will take a while to, another generation, I guess. Howard.
Since there's nobody else up, I wonder if I can go sideways a little bit here. Not something that sort of comments directly on what Kevin's had to say, which is extremely interesting, by the way. But just a comment on something Adam said earlier in one of his contributions about the Good Friday Agreement. Adam said, it's a pity Nigel isn't here. He's talking about Nigel McCullough, a member who lives in Northern Ireland. Said, a pity. Well, in a way, it's not a pity Nigel isn't here, because Adam told us that he voted for the Good Friday Agreement. I think when Nigel was last on here, he told us it was before the American election, and he said that if he was in the States, there's a good chance he would vote for Biden. And there was a bit of a sort of row about that at the time. But
I think it's worth our considering, not at this point, but as maybe one of the Wednesday night sort of questions that we discuss, whether it's appropriate ever for people who are socialists, or members of the party in particular, to vote for one capitalist side or another in these, either in elections or in referendums or in any such things. It makes me extremely uncomfortable. I can understand that people are viscerally inclined to do this. Who didn't want to see Trump get beaten? But for us as socialists to actually decide we're going to support one capitalist side or another, I think we undermine ourselves. That's my view. But as I say, it might be worth our having a debate on this. One Wednesday evening.
Thanks, Howard. Adam?
I don't want to put Kevin on the spot, but there have been a number of referendums in the South of Ireland on divorce, abortion, contraception, and so on. I don't know, but I would assume that as an individual, he or other socialists in the South of Ireland could in fact have voted for these sorts. And incidentally, Nigel's reason for voting for the Good Friday Agreement was by Kevin, because it put an end to the killing. It wasn't taking sides. It was saying, look, they've given us a chance. The capitalist class given us a chance to make a choice. If it stops the killing, okay. But perhaps Kevin will say something about the various referendums on these social issues. Obviously, referendums on constitutional and changing the constitution, we couldn't care less about. But surely a referendum, for instance, allowing divorce would be something a socialist might be able to vote for.
Over the years, there's been a number of these referenda, these kind of basically rowing back on the Catholic nature of Ireland. And I've, as Adam says, I've always voted for what would be the liberal or the non-Catholic side. They're all kind of clear. I mean, to me, it's our party. We're not a reformist party, but we do support individual reforms once they're genuine, of course, and not stupid. So I've voted for the legalization of divorce and for a more sensible abortion regime and gay marriage. I vote for them. I don't obviously vote for with other constitutional things that have nothing to do with promoting people's well-being or the interests of workers, or I don't vote in elections. I mean, I've sympathy for Nigel. I mean, I care about because the Good Friday Agreement to me was a reform. You weren't voting for anything particularly capitalist about it. So I think it's okay, in my opinion, for a socialist to vote for the Good Friday Agreement as opposed to be opposed to it. But obviously, like most members would say, I draw the line on voting for Joe Biden. I mean, like everyone, I was thrilled to see Trump booted out. But of course, I don't think a socialist can really start. It's meaningless if we start out voting for guys like Joe Biden. But I think it'd sort of be nice to have a talk. I think as Howard was saying about this issue.
Okay. Before Norman comes in, Janet Carter, I see you've been typing in the speaking queue a few times. I'm just wondering whether or not you wanted to say anything or am I...
No, thank you, Carla. That must be a mistake. Sorry, no.
All right, no, that's fine. That's fine, Janet. Okay, Norman.
Okay, yeah, you're great. Sorry about that. I was just... good evening, everyone. I echo Kevin's sentiments. I was glad to see Trump going as well. And my God, the reluctance, all that nonsense about voter fraud. I think his main concern, when he lost his presidential immunity, that he would end up in jail and indictments are flying thick and fast. Now, the prosecutors in New York have managed to seize his financial records, so they'll have a field day with that. But on to the subject at hand. See, the nationalists, have been gaining in strength politically over recent years, and it's quite surprising to think that they have, a slight majority in seats now. This Brexit God knows what the long-term repercussions of that will be. What we have now is a situation where Northern Ireland has become, to some extent, economically detached, you know, from the rest of the UK. It's retained the membership, you know, of the single market. And the way some nationalists, I like to hear, you know, Kevin's views on this, especially. I imagine some nationalists are quite happy about this because not that economic detachment will lead to political detachment necessarily, but I wonder if they might be viewing this as a step, you know, in the right direction. That's all I've got to say. Thank you.
Yeah, actually, very good point, Norman. And I remember at the time, the vote in Northern Ireland, a majority in Northern Ireland didn't want Brexit, but it wasn't that one-sided. I think it was 55 voted to remain and 45 voted to leave. And the turnout in Catholic areas was quite small. And it was remarked, and I think it's true, that Sinn Féin were telling their people not to vote to Sinn Féin were opposed to Brexit. Sorry, they were, Sinn Féin obviously didn't want Brexit, but they could see the opportunity. So I think Sinn Féin played it's a political game. Obviously, they said, you know, it's in our interest for Brexit to go ahead because it's, as anyone I think could have seen, it was obvious going to be problematic for Northern Ireland. And so I would say you're spot on, Norman, that Sinn Féin see, I mean, obviously, officially, they're concerned about the workings of the Northern Ireland Protocol and the hassle it's causing. But of course, if you're promoting Northern Ireland, you want to make Northern Ireland as troublesome as unworkable as possible. Like, because you can say, well, would you believe it? We have a nice ready-made solution, oven-ready unification to hand. So, no, I think that's true. I think Sinn Féin are very aware of the benefits of Brexit for them.
Paddy?
Just to respond to Howard's point that thank you for that suggestion for a Wednesday. That sounds like a good idea. We could certainly look at that. For anybody here who doesn't know about Wednesdays, who doesn't usually come because not everybody does, it's a sort of opportunity for a more sort of freewheeling and kind of speculative approach to the politics than sort of much more discursive, we can have some quite interesting discussions. So if you haven't been to a Wednesday one, do try it. And but my main two thoughts were about this kind of general agreement. Oh, aren't we so glad that Trump has been booted out? Well, yeah, but I wonder if we might actually live to be sorry to see him go, along with Trump, along with Corbyn, and probably along with Boris Johnson, really, actually, after the pandemic's over and the public inquiry, you know, which we kind of expect will probably crucify him and the Tory government. When these clowns have disappeared, the problem for us is that politics will then return to what it was before they appeared on the scene, a sort of grey mediocrity that nobody bothers to talk about. I mean, if you remember how things used to be, no one was interested in politics. And then these lunatics come along and shake everything up. And then suddenly everybody's talking about it. And I sort of worry in a perverse way that once these narcissistic demagogues have departed like the dinosaurs they are, you know, it's all going to go back to this kind of flat grey dullness. And my other thought was that I'm also slightly concerned that if there ever is a United Ireland and Arlene Foster really does decide to leave Northern Ireland, she might come and live in England and possibly, horror of horrors, move in next door to me. That's me.
Aaron.
Yeah, just a quick reply to Paddy. It's on the Trump business. As someone who lives in the States, Trumpism isn't going away. You know, the GOP is Trump's party now. That's been proven with the second impeachment hearings. So, what's going on, you know, the circus which is American politics is going to be here for the foreseeable future. And, you know, it's kind of scary, to be honest, you know what I mean? But Trumpism is not going to go away. I'm sure he has aspirations to run in 24. That's a long way away. But the likes of Ted Cruz or Josh Hawley, people like that in American politics, you know, they actually make Trump look like an amateur, because these guys are actually a lot smarter and a lot meaner than Trump. So, you know, the Republican Party is not a nice party at the moment, if it ever has been. Sorry.
Thank you. Adam?
Yeah, just wanted to say something about Sinn Féin and Brexit. I'm sure Kevin can confirm this, but in various referendums that they had in Treaty of Lisbon and so on, the Sinn Féin was advocating to vote against the common market, you know, to vote against these treaties. And now they've, you know, been completely opportunist and are saying the opposite. But another thing about this agreement with Northern Ireland, so Northern Ireland is now in the UK market. I mean, maybe this would be, it could be an advantage from that. At least from if you're a multinational corporation, if you invest in the North of Ireland, you've got access both to the single market and to the UK market. So it might not necessarily, be a bad thing from the point of view of business in that part of the world. Anyway, so perhaps Kevin can confirm what I said before about Sinn Féin originally being against the EEC.
Adam, you're spot on again. In fact, Sinn Féin was the party of Brexit long before Nigel Farage was on the scene. They opposed Ireland joining the European Union in 1973, and they consistently opposed every sort of further deepening or more and more integrating the countries like Ireland into the European Union. And again, about 10 years ago, it changed. Party was this kind of electoral strategy, obviously, you know, it's, you know, extreme Brexit position doesn't win you some votes, but loses you probably a lot more. And also, as I say, opportunistically, they could see with the growing Brexit movement in the UK, being in favour of the EU would be beneficial to them. And of course, because, you know, it is silly in some ways, because Sinn Féin is an out-and-out nationalist party. So in some ways, they should be completely opposed to entries like the European Union. So the support for the European Union is solely opportunistic. The point, I think, the other point, by the way, it's been made Northern Ireland. It's got the best of both worlds, because it's got access to the single market and access to the UK market. And it's true. I'd say for capitalists, that's interesting. But I think they want the security. They don't want to spend a lot of money investing in Northern Ireland. And then it's, you know, they lose access to one of the out of those markets. So, but if it stabilized and if, you know, the position of Northern Ireland became the settled position for a while, then I think you would see, you know, because you can imagine, you know, all the people like who make electric batteries for cars. That's a really great place to locate now in Northern Ireland, because the EU will demand that all car, you know, all electric cars, and that they're going to dominate the market. The batteries have to be made in somewhere in the European Union, or at least if they are made, then they can export it. So there's probably capitalists right now dreaming up schemes. But like all capitalists, they do need political certainty before they commit their money.
Okay, time's passing. Is there anyone else like to comment or ask a question? No? Kevin, do you want to come back with anything? Do you want to... Oh, wait a minute, Steve.
Hi, this is slightly off topic, but I wonder if the
Steve, we've lost you.
I wonder if Kevin could comment on the.
We've lost you again, Steve.
Gaelic as the. Sorry, I'm breaking up.
You are indeed.
Hello.
Yeah.
Oh, leave it then. Sorry, leave it.
Sorry, Steve. Okay, anyone else? Kevin, do you want to come back?
Do you want to finish up? I'll just say thanks again. It's always a privilege to be allowed to speak. I think one or two people I see a message from Steve about on the GAA. Is that the sports body? I like sport, the GAA, but I don't have much politics to say. But I have nothing else to say, I think. But great, thank you very much, and thanks to everybody contributing. I'm going to attend more of these talks going forward. Thanks to you, Carol, again, for running the show here.
Okay, and thank you, Kevin, for a great talk, and everyone else for a good discussion. So with that, I think we should say good night.
Thanks, Kevin. That was really good.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kevin.
Bye.
Thank you.
Good night, all. Thanks, Kevin. Bye.
Good night. Yeah, cheers, Kevin. All the best, guys and girls.